Okay, Mr. Winger.
May it please the court.
Let me say before your light goes to, we obviously gave this more time. Neither side should feel compelled to use all of the extra time that we gave it. Please. But as you can see, we don't ride the clock anyhow. This case obviously has a great deal of interest, not just legally but practically, to the community, the folks in the school, to the kids. And so we wanted to make sure that we gave it a full hearing and that nobody thought that we're cutting off an argument or presentation because the LED spit out red wavelength light as opposed to green wavelength light.
I appreciate that very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, Randall Winger for appellants, and I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
When Congress passed Title IX, it prohibited sex discrimination in schools but maintained separate spaces for boys and girls. Sex under Title IX, in our case law, has to do with the anatomical differences between men and women based on our reproductive nature. Congress was not dealing with a very different concept of gender identity.
What do you think they thought of it? You think this was in Congress's mind when they had the Title IX?
And no, I don't think it was in their mind, and I think that cuts. I think it cuts our direction.
What about Justice Scalia's statement? I can't remember what case he came from, but basically, what?
Uncully, I believe.
I'm sorry.
Uncully.
Okay, you know where I'm going then.
And certainly there, Congress's pronouncements can mean a lot more than what they had intended in their mind, but we're still governed by the law itself. So the principle is what does the law do with regard to Title IX, and what is the case law then with regard to the constitutional right to bodily privacy?
Can you read Pricewaterhouse into that?
Certainly. Pricewaterhouse, of course, dealt with discrimination against a woman because she was not considered feminine enough. And so that stereotype then was considered to be, as an extension, sex discrimination under Title VII. The logical counterpart of that would be if there was a girl in the school who was considered too masculine to be able to use the girl's facilities, it would be a Pricewaterhouse violation to prohibit that girl from using those facilities. So at the end of the day, Congress in Title IX was talking about sex and protections on the basis of sex, and our case law has been clear that when there are real differences between men and women that are relevant to the case at hand, that's what's to be taken into account, not mere stereotypes themselves. And so our physical differences or bodily differences have been considered to be relevant. For instance, the United States Supreme Court in the BMI case, when they were ending discrimination on the basis of sex in entry to the Virginia Military Institute, at the same time, Justice Ginsburg stated that alterations were necessary in order to afford members of one sex privacy from membership of the opposite sex. And we're clearly thinking about the different physical differences between men and women because that's the language they used, language that she stated.
This policy, if we can go back to the policy that your clients are complaining about, this policy applies to everybody. All sexes are treated, biological sexes are treated the same.
That's correct.
So how is this in contravention of Title IX? If everybody's treated the same.
Including gender identification.
Yeah.
So girls are identified, right? The terminology is very, very tricky, and I don't want to be rude or offensive to anyone. Somebody, because I don't know how I say this, but I think you understand what I'm saying. Girls who identify as being boys are treated the same as boys who identify as being girls.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true. A student who's transgender has the choice of asking the school and using the facilities of the opposite sex as three.
See, that's what I'm saying. And the opposite sex, that complicates the discussion.
Well, actually, Your Honor, I do want to use that language to be clear.
It's not clear at all. That does not enhance the clarity. If I hear the term transgender boy or transgender girl, then I can get my head around that and understand what we're talking about.
Well, and I guess I'd like to draw the court's attention then, as a preliminary matter, to what the expert said in this case. Appellee's expert stated that sex has to do with our anatomical differences, gender identity has to do with, as he put it, our our subjective beliefs about gender, and those terms stand in contradistinction because transgender wouldn't make any sense apart from this
term. Now, the human being, since you're in my house, our house, your house too, since you pay for it, and let's use a terminology that is, at least to my simple mind, most conducive to understanding and the most respectful to the persons involved here. Transgender boy tells me who we're talking about. Transgender girl tells me who we're talking about. I know for reasons beyond my comprehension, you don't approve of those terms, don't like to use those terms, but it greatly enhances the communication.
I will obviously do my best, Your Honor. The difficulty is that so many of our cases turn on what the nature of sex is and what opposite sex means. And I guess
stay away from the term. I said the word division. When I use the term sex, I said that's going to complicate the discussion. It's not that simple. That's why I use the term transgender girl, transgender boy, to try to get around that problem.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to be difficult. I will do my best. But when the Supreme Court, and when Congress has been using the terminology about sex, it's been talking about the bodily differences that are relevant. And so if I could draw the court's attention to the Nygaard case.
So you're saying that the sex to which one identifies is not relevant, you're saying?
It's not irrelevant to the discussion, but when the court has been talking about what sex means, it's been talking about the anatomical differences, the bodily differences that aren't mere stereotypes, but are relevant to these discussions. And so from a very fundamental level, what we're coming here to talk about today is bodily privacy, which turns on
the
bodily...
We've left Title IX now. We're going to bodily privacy because Title IX has a statutory language that says you're not supposed to be discriminated based upon sex. Your argument is sex is a biological state of affairs. I understand your position on that. That's your position. But everybody is being treated the same under the school's policy. Transgender students and the biological students, from your point of view, you're going to use your words just for this minute because I'm with Judge Key. You have to use language that's clear. Everybody's treated the same. I don't understand how you could have a Title IX claim here.
Not everyone is treated the same. So a transgender boy can use both the boys' facility or the girls' facility. And a transgender girl can use both the girls' facility or the boys' facility.
Well, if that were true, and your friend across the way is, whose body language suggesting they don't agree with that, but if that were true, then you would still have a classification that does not rise to the level of sex discrimination, wouldn't you, under Title IX?
Well, under Title IX, included within sex discrimination is harassment on the basis of sex. We understand that there can be harassment on the basis of sex when there is somebody who has the opposite body type in that setting. And so we would certainly understand.
So the mere presence of an individual, we're leaving the statutory sex discrimination, you're moving now to the hostile environment argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Understand, for instance, a male maintenance worker being told that he can enter the girls' locker room to fix the locker while the girls are changing. And a school would not...
While girls are changing? And you're really complicating this. Well, that's not in this case in any event.
I'm trying to give a hypothetical to understand how this would work. So a school would not tell a male maintenance worker that he can enter, not because he thinks a male maintenance worker is going to do some kind of bad act or that they hate the male maintenance worker, but the presence of a male in the female setting while they're changing would constitute sexual harassment. We get that as well.
Wait. That's not the real hypothetical. Help me understand what you're saying. You're saying the presence of a male maintenance worker to fix a locker while the girls are changing would constitute
sexual harassment. Yes.
Improper itself, I'm not sure it would constitute harassment.
We have case law as well.
A subordinate of a male custodian going in to perform his job function while girls are changing. In
right.
Itself is harassment. That's what you're saying.
Because of the bodily privacy at issue for the girls.
Now you're in the right of privacy.
Well, no. Because sexual harassment can turn on bodily privacy concerns. So in in Lewis v. Triborough Bridge, for instance, the Second Circuit found that there was sexual harassment.
Because the employees were rubbing up against females in and out of the way the room where they were going to be changing.
There were other bad acts that were occurring as well, but the court said specifically, entering the women's locker room when the female employees were undressed constituted specific acts of sexual harassment.
And how many times did they enter?
I think it was five times.
It was a practice.
We're pervasive, because we can't ignore the pervasive or severe components of this. And that's why the single presence of the maintenance worker, how would that be severe or pervasive?
Sure. And it only needs to be severe or pervasive under Third Circuit precedent. But here we're dealing with a policy. If the employer in Lewis v. Triborough Bridge had a policy that said, men, you can go in anytime you want to, we would understand the pervasiveness of that because it would be inviting the very conduct that was being complained of. Here we actually have a policy that is inviting the very conduct that we're concerned about. So it's happened for two of our clients that they were changing while there was somebody there of the opposite sex, and it can happen anytime these students go back in and use the facility. My client, Mary Smith, anytime that she were to use the locker room or the restroom, risks going in there and seeing someone of the opposite sex changing or being caught while she's changing by someone of the opposite sex.
And so that mere event, from your point of view, is enough to constitute severe or pervasive hostilities.
Yes, and it's because...
Well, there's some additional facts in Lewis that not only would the male employees crowd the entrance to the female locker room, as I said earlier, they brushed up against the female employees, and a supervisor, when the employees complained, the supervisor referred to them as the C word and called them the biggest bunch of effing crybabies.
Your Honor, you're right. There certainly were a lot of other bad acts. Those were sexual harassment as well. But the court was clear that the mere entry itself was...
Where in the world, in this case, and I'll download out of the opinion in front of me, did the court even suggest, going back to the language from the prior argument, that a single instance of a male going into a female locker room under your scenario to perform his job function would create a hostile environment? That's what you said.
Yes, Your Honor. And you know, because if they're going there because the employer is telling them to go there, it's not as if, in so many of these Title VII cases, for instance, you're trying to establish some kind of practice to pin liability on an employer. And so you're looking for a whole pattern of activity so you can say, look, the employer knew about it, the employer didn't do anything about it, therefore the employer is liable.
Yeah, but the search for a pattern is not just to attach liability, it's to bring the conduct within the language of the statute. That's where the environment comes from. The environment comes from the pattern, not from a single entrance.
Here the pervasiveness comes from the policy itself, which is explicitly inviting folks of the opposite body type, if you will, to come into this setting when it's being used by others to change completely in the common areas of the locker rooms and the restrooms, which we understand from the facts of this case are used to change not just...
Does it invite all folks in or just folks who identify with the same gender, if you will, of the people who would normally be associated with that space?
Well, of course it's the latter, yes. It's not everybody coming in, but the right to bodily privacy and the sexual harassment turn on whether there's somebody of the opposite body type coming into
those spaces. I saw in your brief, or maybe in the argument in the district court, a concession that clients would not have a problem if somebody had actually gone through sex reassignment surgery and physically changed, if they were present in the locker room, even though they would then have a sex, and I'll use the term sex there, that was inconsistent with the sex designated on the birth certificate. In that case, at least one plaintiff, and maybe the group, and maybe you acting for all of them, stipulated that would not create a problem. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, but the facts of this case and what the appellee's expert spoke to was that this is...
When you introduced that hypo with the janitor, the male janitor going into the locker room, we got far, far away from the facts of the case. My question, I think, was a little bit closer. I'm trying to figure out if you have no objection to someone who's going to do sex reassignment surgery in the locker room of the opposite sex.
And that was not universal with the clients. It does raise a very...
Well, I just asked you that, and you said, yes, that my representation was accurate. That was a concession or stipulation.
There were certain of my clients who said, yes, a different body type in there, if they were born of one sex, would not bother them. And I think part of the issue is there are two things going on in this case that we need to understand. One has to do with ontologically what makes somebody one sex or the other sex, and the other has to do with bodily privacy. To be asking the kids what makes a sex one sex or the other sex, it was difficult. They were grilled for a while on those issues. But practically speaking, all we're asking for here is a return to the status quo ante from prior to 2016, which is determined on our anatomical differences within the school.
So it's on the record to Dr. Leibowitz's testimony that suggests that even though that is not now a problem, it will soon become a problem if we go back to the status quo ante, because it seems like the border ante, the border town school seemed to promulgate a policy to head off the kinds of issues that will arise if the school district were to do what you suggest, and that is given the suicide rates and everything else, and the impact that could have on kids whose sexual identity is inconsistent with the birth certificate designation of sex. It would create another problem, wouldn't it?
Well, and Dr. Leibowitz said that the science in this case is an evolution. He said that he doesn't look to the harms to third parties. He said that there are no studies with regard to opposite sex usage, whether it hurts his clients or doesn't hurt his clients. He doesn't do follow-up research with his clients. But
is there any issue about the disparate suicide rates and mental health issues between kids who are transgender and kids who are not transgender?
We certainly need to help all students. We need to respect all students, particularly transgender students. But when you go through Dr. Leibowitz's testimony, he makes clear that much of what is important is helping those who've got gender dysphoria. But he was very clear that there was no study with regard to whether cross-sex usage of those facilities helps or hurts.
You're saying cross-sex. And again, to my ear, the provincial mind, I guess I've been reading too much Dickens. You're going to an area that I have...
And so I'll say cross...
It's not really cross-sex. To my mind, that's a very different situation, a different set of circumstances.
The way that the court has used sex has always been...
Cross-sex. Has the court used the term cross-sex as opposed to transgender?
The court has talked about one sex and that. Other sex has talked about opposite sex, and bodily privacy turns on those things. The court has been clear that there really is a difference between the sexes based on our physical differences. So,
well, I think we can take judicial notice of that. We all agree on that. There's a difference between sexes and physical difference.
And so what's relevant here is the actual bodily differences. That's where bodily privacy doesn't make sense apart from the bodily differences between these two groups of people. Now, typically, getting back to a question that you had asked earlier about the equal usage of the facilities, which again, those who are seeking privacy can only use one facility, the single user facility. Those who are transgender can use both of the sex-based facilities plus the single user facility.
As I understand the policy, though, once one gets permission to use the facility that's consistent with their gender identity, that's the only facility that they can use other than the single use facility. So I don't think the policy allows everyone to use everything.
Well, that's correct as to any particular student, but the policy is allowing transgender students in general to be able to use either facility. So you've got transgender males using male facility, transgender males using female facility. And so it's not consistent even with the school's
definition of sex. So your argument is that the students who have a transgender status have more rights than everybody else because they can use any facility that they want?
I am saying that, and I wanted to
draw... But that's not what I understand the policy to say. The policy says if you're a transgender student and you've self-identified and want to use that facility consistent with your identity, that's the one you use. So you either use the one consistent with your gender identity or the private facility.
Yes,
and the students who are cisgender may use the facility that's consistent with their biological sex, I'm using your words, or the private facility, correct?
Yes, that's
correct. So everybody's treated the same.
Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse. As to any particular individual,
that's
yes,
too.
This
guy has been resurrected.
Let's move to the privacy issue. Where is your position that cisgender students have a constitutional right not to share a facility or locker room with someone who is a transgender person?
Sure. Pennsylvania law provides students the ability to be able to use a single-sex facility.
My question was in one of constitutional nature. Well, where in the Constitution, because this is
sure.
your constitutional claim has to be based on that.
And sure, the narrow constitutional right is the ability for school children to be able to use a facility based on their sex. And we understand the starting point is Doe versus Luzerne County, where this court stated that there is a 14th Amendment substantive due process right to your partially clothed body from persons of the opposite sex.
And such that someone doesn't force themselves on you, surreptitiously record you. That's what was going on in Doe. That's what they were trying to guard against in Doe.
Problem. Cases like Doe, Lewis, Schrauner, all those cases are cases where the disparate treatment arises from and gives energy to an animus, a discriminatory animus, the result of which is to demean, to dehumanize the persons on the short end of that stick. Clearly that was what was going on in Luzerne County. People were being victimized, being molested, actually. And that's what we have. It was a molestation in Lewis. It's the same kind of thing. But that's not what we have here.
But there was more than that going on in the Doe case, where the court recognized that the decontamination area was one where Doe should expect a reasonable right of privacy from the opposite sex. And so certainly, in every case, you're dealing with a different fact pattern, but the court was clear that first it asked, the issue here is whether one may have a constitutionally protected privacy interest in his or her partially clothed body. Mentioned that it was an issue of first impression, and then went on to say that they located that interest in the 14th Amendment. And so the application here, where we're dealing specifically with school children, with minors, who are in a custodial setting, who aren't there voluntarily, who are more vulnerable because of age, and where we've got a state law also that says you've got a right to use these facilities separately, it becomes an unconstitutional condition to take away the benefit of using those opposite sex facilities on these students waiving the right to bodily privacy.
I heard the red lights on, but can you say that again? Because I lost the argument.
Well, with the right to privacy, we understand from Doe itself that there's a right to bodily privacy. The application in this case would be to school children, and in these particular settings have been set apart for them by state law to be used separately by the sexes. That's a benefit that's been given by the state. It's like the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. A benefit, even if it's a gratuitous benefit, can't be conditioned on waiving a constitutional right. Here the school is essentially saying, in order to use those facilities that have been set apart for you, you have to waive your right to bodily privacy.
Sounds very boring. I went to the bathroom. Go ahead, Dave. Go ahead.
Judge McKee, in view of the fact that the district made separate accommodations, separate facilities available, where is the irreparable harm?
Sure. We would understand in other contexts if a victim of sexual harassment were told, say an employee was told, hey, you're going to be involuntarily moved to another setting, we wouldn't consider that solving sexual harassment. We would just consider that institutionalizing the sexual harassment. So when there are facilities that are set apart to be used separately by the sexes and that's then taken away, it doesn't solve the harassment by saying go somewhere else.
Puts the rabbit in the hat and assumes there was harassment.
Yeah.
And you're getting harassment from the presence in the same space, private space, of persons who some of them identify with the same sex they were born with, the same sex but on the birth certificate, put it that way. And others identify the sex that is not the sex on the birth certificate. And you're saying that's where the harassment comes from, the fact that they go to the same space. They were put there, but they're using the same space, even though there are separate facilities available for, they use the term cisgender, for cisgender kids who are not comfortable there have a different, at least restroom, locker room is a different problem, a different restroom they can go to where they won't be put in the situation of feeling uncomfortable. And you're saying out of that comes harassment.
I'm saying when you've got a facility that's set apart for folks and they can only use those facilities, they can only use those facilities at the risk of somebody with the opposite anatomy going
in
there.
That's why I use the term of the single-use bathroom. There are single-use bathrooms there that can be used.
Sure, but again, imagine a student that is sexually harassed in a cafeteria and...
Sexually harassed in a cafeteria?
Sure, there's some other student there who may be sexually harassing the student, and the school's response to that is, hey, let's change around your schedule and eat lunch in the cafeteria in a different period rather than taking care of the harassment.
But and I guess your position is presuming that the presence of a transgender student in the same space, either the bathroom or the locker room, is per se harassing.
And therefore, somebody with the opposite biology, regardless, is per se harassing, which would be consistent with the principle that we see all over the case law, whether it's constitutional law, 14th Amendment, 4th Amendment, whether it's discrimination law, whether it's criminal law, we see these issues pop up again and again. And I think the BMI case is particularly interesting because there you've got one where the Supreme Court is trying to deal with the problem of discrimination between the sexes and at the same time talked about the necessity of being able to keep the spaces separate, where our sister circuit courts talking about why we have separate locker rooms and restrooms on the basis of sex, and it has to do with our real bodily differences. And it's the existence of those bodily differences that is relevant to
discussion. Well, I guess I understand that would be a more helpful argument if we didn't have the concession that if someone was in the boys' locker room, who at that point in time physically presented as a boy, but was born under circumstances where the birth certificate reflected that was a girl, that's what the person had gone through the sex change and sex reassignment process, there your clients wouldn't have a problem. That was the concession rule that came at you had earlier.
What we're asking for is just a return to the status quo.
That reminds me of, you could have come in during the era of Brown versus Board of Education and saying, look, if they got one under Plessy, we just want to go back to the status quo. If the law of the land was, let's just keep the status quo, these kinds of disputes wouldn't happen. They happen because of changes, obviously. So going back to the status quo doesn't solve the problem, because the high school obviously thought there were some real problems with the status quo that they either wanted to head off or they wanted to address. And we're here to find out whether or not the request for an injunction that would go back to the status quo is justified, a preliminary injunction, is justified because you've made a reasonable showing of irreparable harm, likelihood of irreparable harm, or likelihood of success on the merits if you don't return to the status quo. And these are my questions, and I think Judge Nygaard's questions, Judge Schwartz's questions, are trying to get at some coherent approach to what you're asking us to do And that's complicated by the fact that I'm asking you about the concession that your clients apparently have no problems being in a locker room with someone who is at that time physically presents of a sex different from his on the birth certificate. And to me, that just seems to come down to some kind of rank subjective judgment about that person as opposed to a Title IX issue or a right of privacy issue. Because the student doesn't know what's on the kid's birth certificate.
There are difficult philosophical questions that are raised
by
this.
That's a very practical question. I tried to keep Sartre out of this. That's a very practical question that I just asked you. If boy A, say Jane, oh, there's a Jane Doe, you forget Jane, it's Sally. Abigail, my granddaughter's name. Abigail's in the locker room. Abigail's a cisgender girl. My understanding is that Abigail is saying that if someone comes into the locker room who is physically at that moment consistent with a girl, I don't mind that. But if I later find out that on that person's birth certificate, the person at the time of birth was identified as being a male, then the parade of horribles come in. My right of privacy is being infringed upon. I'm being harassed because I'm in the locker room with someone who is born a boy and not a girl.
And to be clear, the legal argument that we're making has to do with our bodily differences. But you can understand that a lot of people look at the issue of what sex is, and there are a lot of different answers in terms of what sex is. Can you change a sex by going through bodily changes? And so part of what was going on during that question...
Your clients would say, yes, you can, because in my hypothetical, Abigail doesn't mind, I think I mixed that up when I presented to you, Abigail wouldn't mind being in a locker room with someone who presents as a girl, but the birth certificate says he's a boy.
And that particular question...
You object to that. You do not object to that.
The legal argument that we're making is that the bodily differences are what's critical to our bodily privacy.
And so the bodily differences, the anatomical differences, the moment the two people are in the room is what we should focus on.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying that someone who has gone through the full transition has maybe the person who's transgendered to be female can stay in the female locker room, restroom, as long as that's the full sex change has happened. Anatomical changes have occurred.
And Your Honor, if you were going to...
Yes, is that a yes?
Yes, that is the logic of the argument that we're making.
The two different things that you're saying. Yes, that is the logic. Take logic out of it. I'm just asking you if yes is the answer to her question.
Yes is the answer to that. Yes is the answer to her question.
Alright.
And again, it is the bodily differences that make a difference for how we use these facilities.
Can someone go through sex reassignment procedures until they reach the age of 18?
That's what the appellate's expert was referring to in saying that this is not something.
Can they go through reassignment processes before the age of 18? Because if they can't, then you're in an Alice in Wonderland situation here, because the situation that you're saying is okay, these high school kids can't get there because I would imagine almost all of them are under the age of 18.
You are exactly correct, Your Honor.
All right. Okay, thank you. You served some time, I think, for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Mike Levin. I represent the Boyertown Area School District, the defendant and appellee. I want to note that the three individual school district administrators who were named as defendants have been dismissed by agreement of the parties, and the school district and the intervener are the only appellee parties. Let me verbalize what my body language was that Judge McKee observed. Judge Schwartz was 100% correct that under the practice of the school district, once a transgender student has asked to use either the bathroom or locker room that is consistent with their gender identity, they are not allowed to flip-flop and go back. And also, as Judge Schwartz alluded to, there is a transition period. These things don't happen overnight. And
when you say these things, what are you referring to?
The transgender transfer. So a student could be transgender and not yet be ready to use a bathroom or a locker room consistent with his or her gender identity.
And this, what you're saying, I assume, is coming from Dr. Leibowitz's testimony?
Correct. And partially also from Aidan DiStefano, where he described his transition. So it comes from both of those things. But and typically, and some of the other courts, in fact, the Grimm decision, which was issued 2 days ago, is an excellent summary of the case law as well as the issues of transitioning with respect to transgender. The students typically start with things like changing their name from a feminine to a masculine name. They may start hormone therapy, etc. And then ultimately they get to the position where they want to transition into using the bathrooms or locker rooms consistent with their gender identity. And this process at the Boyertown, the student has to work with his or her guidance counselor, and the guidance counselor, working with the administrators, ultimately will give approval at the appropriate
what
time.
What training the guidance counselor? Are they special guidance counselors in terms of having a special background or special training, or selected because of their unique sensitivity in this area, or is it just kind of? My guidance counselor was also my high school history teacher. He was terrible. He was also a soccer coach. He was rousing in all 3 years. Is it someone like that? You've got not enough salary, so you bring somebody in, you make them a guidance counselor?
No, in order to be a guidance counselor in Pennsylvania's public school system, you have to be properly educated and properly certificated. You cannot be a counselor if the only certification you have is history or math or any of the other academic subjects. So it is a specialized situation. As the court is well aware, the plaintiff's case in this case is based upon two legal constructs. One is constitutional right to privacy, and the other is the alleged sexual harassment in violation of Title IX. We do not believe that this case meets either of those definitions for the primary reason that there are private spaces available in terms of special locker rooms, single user bathrooms, etc.
Conceding that there is a right to privacy, because that the existence of these alternative facilities would only be implicated if there was a compromise of the privacy right.
For the purposes of this case, I don't know that we need to make that concession. But if the school district recognizes,
she's asking you, you want to make it, if you don't want to make it,
I'm not suggesting you need to.
Yeah.
It's your choice. I'm just wondering, when you jump right to the alternative facilities, we would only get there if there was a privacy right that should be recognized.
Well, there are certain privacy implications. That cannot be denied. But the plaintiff's articulation of the privacy interest is very unusual, because they're saying that they have a right to privacy to go into rooms that are inherently not private. All kinds of other students are in the room. They're not shielded from view from other people, nor are they shielded from seeing other people.
Well, I thought they were shielded. I thought you put in shower stalls in the group locker, group shower rooms, whatever they're called, that they are now actually individualized, which I had a hard time imagining.
The shower stalls are individualized, but the group or communal locker room is not.
Okay.
And as we all remember, the United States Supreme Court indicated that the level of privacy in a locker room is different than other kinds of privacy. So I can see that there's something that has to do with privacy, but it is met by the facts in this case of the separate locker rooms, of the single user bathroom.
I just want to go back to what you said before you talk about the right to privacy has been met by these alternative avenues. I thought what you were also saying was you think the definition of the right that's being described by the plaintiff is far broader than would be recognized, in part because the facilities at issue, in this case the locker rooms and the multi-user bathrooms are not private in the sense that you can expect, you have an expectation of privacy that no one will be there, but they're in public buildings, first of all, but they're also, you expect other people to be there. Is that your position?
Correct.
Can I ask about that? I just want to jump to Title IX for a second. My question really has to do with the rescission in 2017 of the Dear Colleagues letters in 15 and 16. Does that affect anything, either the district court's opinion or your position in this case, the rescission of those letters?
It doesn't affect the legal analysis in any way. Factually, the school district made their decision administratively after the Obama 2016 letter. So from a factual standpoint, that's the only relevance. From our legal standpoint, we're not relying on that in any way. But to get back to the plaintiff's privacy argument, they inject several other aspects of it. Their right to privacy, they combine with their alleged constitutional right to go into the communal bathroom and the communal locker rooms, rather than saying, okay, like any other person, we can choose whether to go there or go into the private locker room and single-user bathrooms. So now they're combining what's really not privacy into a right that they have to be able to go into the communal rooms, and there's nothing in the law upon which that is built. Then they go one step further. They want to define who can be in the room. And their definitions of sex have changed over time in this case because they have realized, I believe, that some of their definitions of sex don't stand up to logical scrutiny. If you look at paragraphs 28 and 29 of their amended complaint, they define sex differently.
Where is it in the appendix? What page in the appendix?
I don't have that with me. Paragraph 28 of the amended complaint, quote, the term sex refers to one's biological / anatomical status as either male or female, end of quote. Well, if that is the definition, getting back to some of the comments and observations you made, Judge McGee, when there's surgical intervention, you change the anatomical status of the individual. Three of the original four plaintiffs were unwilling to have that person sit in the locker room with them. One of the plaintiffs, as was referred to by the court, was willing to have that person. So they're not even in unison about does anatomy matter. You then go to paragraph 29 of the amended complaint, where they say sex is fixed at conception, binary, objectively verifiable, and rooted in our human reproductive nature. And many of the cases have talked about the problems associated with that definition. But the plaintiff's logic has eroded, and the foundation of their argument has eroded even further to the extent it is based upon this concept of sex. Because in footnote number 2, they change the definition of sex again. In that footnote, they said, quote, appellants use sex as referring to male or female as grounded in reproductive biology. Sex is binary, fixed at conception, and objectively verifiable. That's not consistent with one of their own clients, but that is what they are saying now. In contrast, we suggest that the transgender students, when they have gender identity, meet the definitions of sex. And if the school district were to do what the plaintiffs want them to do, I believe that the school district would be met with the political, the legal challenges that others who have excluded transgender. I don't have to remind the court of the North Carolina bathroom bill, and how the country reacted to that, how the courts enjoined that and how the state ultimately rescinded the main emphasis of the bathroom bill. Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh, which was one of the first cases dealing with transgender rights, Judge Gibson ruled in favor of the university that the transgender student did not have the right to use the bathrooms or locker rooms of his choice. Pittsburgh University settled that case and allowed the student there. Pine Ridgeland School District, same thing. They adopted a rule consistent with what the plaintiffs would want them to adopt. They were sued. The judge enjoined the rule, and that school district settled the case and allows transgender students to use the bathrooms and locker rooms with which they identify. Minersville School District is
the latest. This doesn't help us. That really doesn't help us deal with their assertion of a Title IX privacy, Title IX violation or a privacy violation in this case.
But okay. Are you trying to say that if you went back to the status of affairs before the policy, the school will be opened up to equal protection claims by the transgender students?
Equal protection.
So how does the court balance the equal protection considerations of the transgender students against what these plaintiffs contend are privacy interests of the cisgender students?
The school district did it by offering private facilities available, and I think that the analysis in the Pine Ridgeland case is right on, and that is all students get to choose which bathrooms or locker rooms they want based upon their gender identities. And it applies equally to both sides. Anyone who has privacy concerns can use privacy.
It's a little more than that, because a student just can't come in, as you said, and say, well, I want to use the bathroom or the other sex I don't identify with them. It's just not that simple. There's a process put in place. It's overseen by trained professionals, licensed professionals, as to when that can occur. So the record is clear on that.
The last point I would like to make is the arguments made by the appellants about transgender folks simply having a subjective belief. The findings of fact by the court below, as well as testimony.
I didn't hear that. Is it the It's a breeze, but I didn't hear that argument today from
There was one reference to it. The expert made it clear that these are more than simply subjective ideas. They're core beliefs, and they last over time, and the judge found those facts based upon that testimony.
Well, that's why I mentioned the stats.
Unless the court has any other questions. Thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions?
I have none. Thank you, Judge.
Sure.
Good morning, and may it please the court.
Say good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon. Good day.
It is good day, Your Honor. That's always a safe choice. I'm Rhea Marr from the American Civil Liberties Union, and I represent Intervenor Appellee, the Pennsylvania Youth Congress. Plaintiffs ask this court to do something extraordinary. Tell a school district that it is constitutionally prohibited from continuing to allow transgender students to use the facilities that match their gender identity, a practice that has been in place for nearly 2 years. The district court did not abuse its discretion in denying that unprecedented request at the preliminary injunction stage. As the district court found based on unrebutted expert testimony, excluding transgender students from facilities that match their gender identity can disrupt their education, cause significant psychological harm, and deeply stigmatize them.
Can I ask you a question? In some of the other cases where the plaintiff is the transgender student seeking access, among their complaints when schools or institutions say, well, you can use the private facility, is you're stigmatizing me, you're treating me differently. Why isn't that the flip? Here we have the cisgender students who have expressed concerns about their privacy telling them, well, you can use the private facility. Why aren't they also have the same arguments or the type of arguments as the transgender students when they serve as the plaintiffs?
It's very different, Your Honor, for at least two reasons. And the first is, when it comes to students who are transgender, many of these students have gender dysphoria,
and Dr. Leibowitz testified, and the district court found that gender dysphoria is defined as clinically significant distress, and that distress can be alleviated when students are able to use facilities that are consistent with their gender identity. It can also be exacerbated when students are excluded from those facilities and can lead to serious psychological harms of the kind that Judge McKee indicated earlier. That's not the case when we're talking about cisgender students who do not suffer from gender dysphoria.
So the differential in treatment is the impact on the particular person. It's more either documented, serious, et cetera.
There is a serious clinical distress involved, but there's another reason as well, which is for the plaintiffs, right, there's a profound difference between choosing to use single-user facilities because of one's own belief about modesty or any other reason and being required to use those facilities because of someone else's belief that who you are, your very presence, is unacceptable. And that stigma, that differential treatment, is why it's discrimination in cases like the Grimm case, right, to exclude a student and tell them that they are unfit to even be in spaces where other people are present.
How much of that is going on here? Now, to the extent you can answer that, the answer that's rooted in the record, but some of the argument that was suggested or that I read, that's why I used the term animus before, that's a distinction between cases like the Zurn County and the Highway case, the Turnpike case, where there's clearly an animus driving the policy that separates, as opposed to a policy that seems to be based upon clinical recognition of a real problem and how do you head that off in the context, the very delicate and sensitive context of adolescent kids.
Your Honor is absolutely correct that there's an important difference, and as the school district council explained, the district initially had made this decision to adopt a policy of inclusion following the Obama Dear Colleague letter, but it voted after the rescission of that guidance to continue the practice after having nearly a full school year's experience with it and seeing that that practice was good not only for transgender students but for the school as a whole. I think the amicus brief from school administrators really speaks to that experience, that adopting policies of inclusion can be a valuable thing for all students. So not only is there not animus towards the cisgender students, but really there's an interest in promoting the well-being of the school as a whole. Contrasting the significant harms that transgender students might experience when they are excluded, the district court made a factual finding that there is no harm to plaintiffs here. And plaintiffs have not challenged that finding as clearly erroneous, and they can't because they admitted before the district court that the single-user facilities would protect their privacy. The district's practice of allowing students...
What about the locker room context? It's to a bathroom that works. What about the locker room context?
Students are not required to change in the locker rooms. They may use the single-user restrooms to do that, and in fact, the school has equipped some of those restrooms with lockers for students to store their belongings during gym. There are also private spaces within the locker room, so the individual shower stalls Your Honor referenced earlier, those are spaces that students do use to change in the locker room. They simply pull the curtain and can change. There are also individual toilet stalls within the locker room that students may use to change as well. So there certainly are private spaces available for any student who wishes to use them for any reason and who may feel uncomfortable changing in front of others. We know everyone has their own sense of personal modesty. I think one of the plaintiffs, Jack Jones, testified even before this practice was adopted, he tended to prefer to change in an area of the locker room that was less crowded. And that makes sense because it makes sense that some students may feel uncomfortable. And the school has addressed that by making a variety of options available to all students. There's nothing unconstitutional about that. In fact, not only is the district's choice legally and constitutionally permissible, but as Judge Schwartz has anticipated, and courts are increasingly recognizing the practice is required under both Title IX and the Constitution. And that means that granting the injunction that plaintiffs have asked for here would actually violate Title IX and the Constitution. And that's another reason why it was not an abuse of discretion for the district court to deny it. We've heard a lot today about the definition of the word sex, and I just wanted to add a few comments to that conversation. First is, when it comes to sex discrimination, the Supreme Court has used the word sex and gender interchangeably, and I think the VMI case, which opposing counsel referenced earlier, is a terrific example of that. You see the court using the word gender when it talks about sex discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause. But more importantly, this court doesn't need to define sex to affirm the denial of the preliminary injunction. As Judge Nygaard indicated, there simply is no irreparable harm here. The district court found, and the plaintiffs haven't contested, that using single-user facilities would protect their privacy. And their only argument for irreparable harm stems from the idea that their harm can be presumed based on the constitutional violation. But as the questioning earlier indicated, of course, they have not established a violation of their constitutional right to bodily privacy. for precisely the same reason, which is that they are not required to expose their intimate body parts to anyone. They're able to use those single-user facilities. So based on that finding that no student is required to undress in front of any student of any gender, this court can affirm on that basis alone. There was also a question earlier about whether there is a constitutional right to bodily privacy that I think applies to the school locker room context. And our answer to that question is yes. There is a right to be free from the involuntary exposure of one's own body parts, and that applies whether we're talking about students of the same sex or students of a different sex. And the key here is that no student is required to expose their intimate body parts in front of any student of any gender. They're certainly not required to strip down nude and remove their undergarments. And in fact, the testimony here was that very few students, if any, do undress fully in the locker rooms. Very few students shower. And for those who do, those facilities have been replaced with individual shower stalls.
Mr. Levin made a very interesting, very good point, which I hadn't, conceptually it seemed to be given, but I hadn't articulated it quite the way he did. And that is, the right to privacy is being asked for through a space that is, by definition, not private. Doesn't mean there's not a right to privacy, but it certainly informs the contours of that right and the scope of that right and what can be done within, even given the most severe test that we apply to fundamental rights. It informs how we view the substantial interest test, seems to me, the fundamental right inquiry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
No, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
The right to privacy is kind of getting muddled here. This is not a Fourth Amendment kind of right to privacy.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think this court in Luzerne County articulated the right very much the way Your Honor did, which is to say it's a context-specific inquiry. We have to look at the circumstances. The court said we're not going to draw a bright-line rule. We're going to look at the circumstances. And the circumstances here are students changing for gym alongside other students, which is precisely the way the facilities were intended to be used. And that is a very different thing from the Fourth Amendment context, and I think the Supreme Court has recognized that. In the case of Safford versus Redding, which involved a strip search of a young girl, and the court talked about the vulnerability and the exposure, and explicitly contrasted that exposure from the type of exposure that's involved in changing for gym class in the locker room, which is simply a very different thing than what's involved in many of plaintiffs' cases, which involve coercive settings or hidden cameras or peepholes or things of that nature. There was also conversation earlier about legislative intent, and many of my points have been made, but I just wanted to add that there's no reason to think that legislators in 1972 would have thought that a transgender student like Aiden DiStefano should actually use the girls' room and not the boys' room. So I think the absence of consideration of gender identity in 1972 simply doesn't cut the way Mr. Wenger thinks it does. I also wanted to address the plaintiff's selective reliance on anatomy. We heard today earlier articulated a bright-line rule for the first time, the idea that someone who has undergone a full transition use facilities. That's the first time we've heard that articulation, and accepting that as their position today, I think it's wrong for at least two reasons. It's wrong as a matter of law in that our rights can't be conditioned on any particular medical treatment, and the EEOC has articulated this very well in the Lusardi case, which addressed the question of whether excluding a woman who is transgender from restrooms and locker rooms in the employment context is sex discrimination prohibited by Title VII. And in holding that it was, the EEOC very clearly stated that the employer in that case, which had said that Tamara Lusardi could not use the restrooms until she had completed the final surgery, and I use scare quotes there because, of course, there's no such thing, and also because the employer never articulated what precisely that surgery was. But the plaintiff's right to be free from sex discrimination can't be conditioned on any form of medical treatment. I also think it's problematic as a factual matter because it...
Exactly, analogous, but I was wondering to what extent the concept of a heckler's veto is kind of lurking around the periphery, at least in my mind, in cases like this. And you don't have to address it, but I'm just, I can't get that out of my mind. That it's very similar to a heckler's veto concept in the First Amendment context.
I think the plaintiff's suggestion that it's their discomfort that therefore translates into a constitutional right to banish others from common spaces is quite troubling.
Well, that's the heckler's veto that I was talking about.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. I did want to just address what I think is wrong factually about the notion that someone who has undergone a quote, final surgery or a certain set of procedures can then use facilities. And that's what Dr. Leibowitz testified, that transition is a process. It can involve, for adolescents, puberty blockers. It can involve hormone treatment. For some students, there are some surgical interventions that may be appropriate, although typically those are not recommended before age 18. They sometimes may be. And so it's not a black and white matter. And our sex-based characteristics may not all align. I think there's a very nice discussion of this in Tuesday's decision from Judge Wright Allen in the Gavin Grimm case, where she talks about the various steps that Gavin has taken over time since his case was filed several years ago. And we see that all of the sex-based characteristics have changed. And at any particular given snapshot, you might have someone who is using a male name, who's using male pronouns, who, when using public spaces, uses the male restrooms and no one bats an eye, who then was able to undergo chest reconstruction surgery and correction and updating of his gender identity documents. And so, you know, at what point do we get there? And I think the answer is to do what the district has done, is to take a case-by-case basis and say, okay, we're going to work with the student and the guidance counselor to figure out, you know, what is the right choice for this student and which facilities are most appropriate for that student to use. And that rule, I think, not the bright-line rule that plaintiffs ask for, is the correct one. As was alluded to earlier, the simple presence of transgender students in restrooms and locker rooms does not violate anyone's constitutional right to bodily privacy. And again, the right there relates to the involuntary exposure of one's own intimate body parts, which was involved in the Luzerne County case. Here, of course, no student is required to expose the intimate parts of their body, both because of the private areas the school has made available, and in fact, the students have admitted that. It's also important to recognize that, you know, up until today, the students have not been objecting, in fact, to seeing any particular anatomical parts or to nudity. In fact, what their objection is to the very presence of transgender people. And we see that one of the plaintiffs, Mary Smith, the basis of her complaint is that she entered the girls' restroom and saw a girl who was transgender washing her hands at the sink. I think that example illustrates so powerfully why this case has nothing to do with privacy or nudity or anyone's intimate body parts. It has to do with an objection to who transgender people are.
The way this has been pled, there's no allegation that private parts have actually been viewed. It's the presence. You're right about that. But in the next case, well, Mr. Levin's point, if we go back to what Mr. Wengler asked for, not suggesting as a matter of law whether we will or not, we haven't decided the case yet. But the next case, in fact, would involve that. It would be pled differently because it would be a situation where there is actual nudity. So that, I'm, at least from my perspective, maybe my colleagues would disagree. Limiting any decision coming out of this to the very narrow confines of the person's presence in the locker room just kind of kicks the can down the road. It doesn't really help as much.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's right, but it's also true that the plaintiffs are claiming not just the right not to be seen, right, but I think what your question or your concern is getting at is the right not to see others.
That,
there's no case that supports that broad and novel reading, that the right to one's own bodily privacy protects against the right not to see others.
Would this case be different if the facts were that instead of the student being seen partially changing for gym, was about ready to enter the shower, and so their backside was exposed? Would your position be different?
Or the front side?
No, because no student... I think I understand the question, so I'll try to answer it, and you tell me if more is needed. Even if there were a right not to see others, plaintiffs, again, can avoid seeing other people changing by using the single-user facilities, so that interest is not implicated as well. I also think it's important to recognize, to the extent there are concerns about intimate body parts being exposed in school areas, you know, the school is free to address those concerns in a non-discriminatory way. So they might, for example, adopt a policy that students may not fully undress in private areas and reveal intimate body parts in front of others, that anyone who wishes to do that use a private area. So the solution is not to banish transgender students from common facilities. There are common sense solutions that school administrators are well equipped to come up with to address the real concerns. But again, those are not the concerns in this case.
You're not suggesting that if a policy were to change to require transgender kids only, to change in a way that does not show their bodies to other kids who may be present, that possibly okay? You're not suggesting that, are you saying?
No, I'm not, Your Honor, and thank you for the clarification. I think the key there is that the school is free to come up with solutions that are non-discriminatory, so solutions that apply to everyone. And again, you know, Dr. Leibowitz testified, and the district court recognized students may be uncomfortable seeing nudity, whether it's someone of the same sex or someone of a different sex, whether or not transgender students are present. So the school might decide to address those concerns by adopting a policy like the one I described, but of course what it can't do is subject transgender students and only transgender students to differential and adverse treatment. To suggest their very presence is unacceptable. Turning to the statutory claim, transgender students using the same restrooms and locker rooms as everyone else also does not amount to sexual harassment. The only courts that have addressed similar claims have rejected them. So the first decision is the 2002 decision from the Eighth Circuit in Cruzan, which involved a teacher who complained that her school had created a hostile environment based on sex by allowing another teacher who was transgender to use the women's restroom. And the Eighth Circuit said that the mere presence of that teacher, who was not alleged to have done anything other than simply use the restrooms, did not rise to the level of a hostile environment and was not sex discrimination under Title VII. And of course, the District Court in Students and Parents for Privacy, the Northern District of Illinois case, the plaintiffs there raised an identical Title IX claim, and both the magistrate judge and the United States District Judge have rejected it. Whatever plaintiff's subjective experiences in the locker room or restrooms may be, the District Court found there is nothing objectively offensive about going about daily life while being transgender. And of course, we talked about the severe or pervasive standard earlier, but not the other element, which is that not only must the conduct be severe or pervasive from one's own perspective, but it also must be objectively offensive. There's nothing objectively offensive about using the restroom while being transgender. What is offensive is comparing being transgender to the outrageous conduct involved in many of the cases that plaintiffs rely on, like a peeping Tom leering at a child, or the Schonauer case Judge McKee referenced earlier, where a supervisor demanded that his employee dance nude. Plaintiffs can point to no case that has found a sexually harassing environment based on another person simply using the facilities as they were meant to be used, regardless of the sex of the people involved. I did want to touch also on this notion earlier that not only is the district's practice permissible, but it is in fact required, as an increasing number of courts have recognized, because sex discrimination includes discrimination based on transgender status. That's because it's impossible to take into account the fact that someone is transgender without taking into account their sex assigned at birth. So it's inherently sex-based. Being transgender also is a form of gender nonconformity under the Price-Waterhouse decision, because being transgender defies the sex-based stereotype that all of us should identify with the sex we were assigned at birth. And courts are increasingly recognizing that excluding transgender people from facilities that everyone else uses is a form of sex discrimination. It's a form of discrimination that marks transgender students and only transgender students as unfit to even be in the same place as other people, simply because of who they are. The injunction that the plaintiffs seek would itself violate Title IX and the Constitution. Finally, we've not talked about the tort claim at all, and I would just briefly add that their tort claim fails because they have no reasonable expectation of being secluded from others for the same reason that seclusion is not about anyone's sex or gender, but rather the expectation of being alone. And there's no expectation that one is alone in a crowded locker room where the district court found up to 60 students may change for gym at the same time. If there are no further questions, we ask this court to affirm the order of the district court. Thank you.
Judge Nygaard, any questions?
I have none. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. And I believe you reserve significant time for rebuttal, Mr. Wenger.
The school has conceded that locker rooms are not private by nature. But let me explain the privacy. Locker rooms have been set up not to have privacy, not to have privacy at the door from persons of the opposite sex. Those who you're changing with, you don't expect privacy within the common areas of the facility because, as the testimony is in this case, there are students who change their clothes, sometimes getting completely naked within those facilities. And the breadth of the opinion below that essentially stated...
Sounds like that we should be coming from over there. You're saying, I would agree with you, that once you get inside the locker room, the door goes closed, but the folks who are in the locker room and are there for the purpose of the locker room, there's no expectation of privacy amongst those folks. That we
amongst the others who are within the room, which is why
there's a lot of privacy here then.
Well, it's why we separate facilities on the basis of sex in the first place, the bodily privacy right.
But you just said there wasn't a right of privacy in that room.
Not... not to persons of the same sex, to persons of the opposite sex. That's why we divide it on the basis of sex. If it weren't for the bodily privacy differences, we wouldn't have separate facilities at all. We'd have one big changing area. But it is those bodily differences that have been an interest strong enough to say, even though we prevent discrimination on the basis of sex, we are still going to maintain separate facilities because of the physical differences between men and women. So the school has conceded that a cisgender male is not permitted to enter the girls' locker room. Once they've decided that they're going to go into the boys' locker room, they can't go into the girls' locker room. I'm sorry, I may have got that
also
upside down.
A cisgender female can't go into the boys' locker room.
A cisgender male is not permitted to go into a girls' locker room.
Right.
And
the converse is true.
Correct. And it's based on biological differences. The principal for the school recognized that the reason that there was a separation of those facilities is because of the privacy that's to be afforded within those spaces. But what is the meaning of privacy?
Well, let's talk about that, right? From the Whitaker case out of the Seventh Circuit, the court makes a statement that says a transgender student's presence in a restroom provides no more of a risk to other students' privacy rights than the presence of an overly curious student of the same biological sex. My difficulty with part of your argument is you have a transgender student who is interested in nothing else than taking care of whatever one is doing, either in the locker room or the restroom, and their presence is infringing your client's rights. But you're saying, I guess, a student who's of the same biological sex but overly curious would not violate their rights?
There's a right to bodily privacy, and that right depends on
that. Answer that question for us. That would be the yes or no.
It may violate their rights for different reasons.
It's the same privacy interest, though. Someone in their they have, you're saying bodily integrity. It's the same privacy interest. And you're saying the transgender student poses a greater risk to violating that right than an overly curious cisgender student.
Because our bodily privacy depends on our bodily differences. And
so in that context, if there's a cisgender female in there being stared at by another cisgender female, that's okay. But if a cisgender female is in there and there's a transgender female walks by, and assume that in both these cases everyone is totally nude, transgender female just walks by, doesn't pay much attention, you're saying that because of the bodily differences, there's a violation in the second situation where the transgender female is not even paying any attention to the cisgender female. But in the first situation where the cisgender female is staring, gawking at the cisgender female who's in the restroom, that's okay.
I'm not saying it's okay. No, Your Honor.
But in the constitutional legal sense, the right of privacy sense, that's not an infringement of the right of privacy of the cisgender female who's in there being gawked at. Because that's where your argument takes you.
I'm not sure what the cause of action is there, Your Honor. I haven't
contemplated that one anymore. But that's where your argument takes you.
The right that we're bringing here has to do with the bodily differences. And the only reason that we have these separate facilities in the first place.
Well, that's why the hypothetical that's posed to you eliminates that issue by putting people in the space of the same birth sex.
Sure, and so it doesn't cause a problem for the same reason. The gawking very well may be a reason that there's a violation, not the bodily privacy because of the bodily differences. So I'm not saying that there's not a cause of action for that. That's not one that I've been investigating. The one that we're founding this on has to do with the right that's existent precisely because of the bodily differences. And to be clear,
the privacy interest is exactly the same, though, isn't it? Maybe there's some tort there that I can't harassment or something like that. Maybe there's some tort action in there. Well, the privacy action is exactly the same, the privacy interest.
I'm not saying that there isn't different ways to get to that privacy interest, but the privacy interest that we've been talking about is based on the bodily differences. And to be clear, we're not opposing using the room with transgender students as long as those transgender students are of the same biological sex as the same body type. So our clients...
Bring that one by me again, because okay. I'm totally confused.
Okay.
What did you just say? You're not opposing them?
Well, what we're saying is our clients have testified that they will use the space with transgender students.
But what use that complicates it? Are you objecting to that use?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
No, not at all.
They have no problem with...
Right.
Let's just be more specific. A cisgender female plaintiff would be fine sharing a facility with a transgender male.
That's correct.
Because they're anatomical, they're anatomically alike.
Exactly. And so the statement made earlier that there's this insinuating to some sort of hatred toward transgender students and their very presence is objected to, all it's being objected to is sharing the facilities with somebody with the opposite body type. And I'd like to point out as well the implications of this. If we say that body type really doesn't matter, instead...
Who is saying that? The body type doesn't matter. You heard Mr. Levin talk about the process they put in place, the licensed folks, the trained professionals they brought in to deal with this. Who is saying that body type does not matter? It's how you address it and how you respond to everything embodied within the body type and some of the gender identification issues that arise from that.
What we're saying at the end of the day is if somebody goes to the school and says, can I use the opposite sex facility, the school says, yes, if you want to use the opposite sex facility.
Who's saying that? Somebody comes in off the street and says, first of all, somebody off the street wouldn't get into the school in this day and age. They have a right to be in the school. And they just going to say, I want to use the opposite sex facility. You're going to get a 911 call.
I'm talking about students. If a student asks to use the opposite sex facility, all they need to do is ask the administration. The administration will ultimately, for every student that is asked that...
Is that on the record? What you're telling me is that what Mr. Levin just represented to us, and which is consistent with the district court's findings of fact, is not true. That is clearly erroneous. That any student can forget the stranger off the street, so you don't have a 911 call anymore. Any student can go into whichever office it is, office of the principal.
Any student who identifies with the opposite sex.
Okay. So any transgender student can come in. Go ahead.
Sure. But the logic of that would apply if we're saying that the biological sex of those students don't matter. The logical implication is the biological sex of a teacher. Does it matter if a teacher is doing a strip search, for instance? So the appellees have been making a lot.
We'll go back to analogies like the janitor that goes into the restroom. I totally got lost with that analogy. Try it again, because I'm not sure I follow your argument.
Sure. The implication of saying that the biological sex doesn't matter if you identify with the opposite sex would apply as well to a teacher, for instance, who needs to conduct a strip search within the school. We always do strip searches with someone of the same sex in order to protect bodily privacy. The logic of this would be that the subjective beliefs...
So you're equating someone going to a bathroom or someone taking a shower in places at appropriate times for doing that is the same as the kind of interaction that one has when they do a strip search? Those two interactions are the same. Casually walking by someone in the locker room on the way to the bathroom or on the way to the shower is the same as someone doing a strip search?
I'm saying that the logical implications are the same. If we're going to...
Why are they the same when the nature of the activity, the nature of the intrusion and the interaction is totally different?
Because once we say that sex is our gender identity rather than biological sex, that naturally follows.
Well, I don't know. Your concept naturally follows is different from mine. It seems to me that's a wholly different scenario. It might require a very different policy, probably a very different lawsuit, if that was the case. But I have to think about that analogy because I just don't equate those scenarios the same as you do.
Your Honor, I see that my time is up, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. You can say that we always, and you've seen this, those are folks who have not familiar with the courtroom procedure, have seen in the prior cases of civil taking that under advisement. Usually when that happens, we decide, we conference the case right away, as we always do, an opinion comes out when the opinion comes out. I don't know when the graduation is for the high school, but whenever it is, this is clearly a matter that's a great deal of importance to the high school administrators, certainly to the kids on both sides of this legal issue, and to the parents on both sides of the legal issue. To the extent that we can, we may not be able to, but to the extent that we can, and we talked about this part before, we want to try to conference the case now, knowing how long that will take, but let's reconvene in no more than 30 minutes. To the extent that we can reach a decision, we'll render a decision. It won't be obviously a thorough analysis or anything like a legal opinion. Although some of my colleagues will probably think that none of my opinions are very well reasoned. You know? but we can at least, hopefully, let you know how we stand on the issue before us. That is the motion for some preliminary injunction. And if we can't do it, we can't do it. But we're going to recess for a few minutes.